You may be seated. If you want to, you can stand up the whole time if you know, if that's your preference. I may choose to sit down or, you know, stand up, either way. But what a joy it is to be in the house of the Lord this morning. And I can already tell from that reception, I'm fighting an uphill battle a little bit today. But I'm so glad and to be in God's house. And you know what? Every Sunday morning that I wake up, there's just something that's special about Sunday morning. At least there's always been for me. I know that every day that we've been given is a gift from God, but there's something extra special about Sunday. I hope that you think that. You're like, yeah, I think that because that's when I get in my best sleep of the entire week. During the message, I got 20 minutes of no interruptions in which I can just sit back and seek the Lord in restful sleep, right? That's what Sunday's all about. That's why it's the day of rest, right? But one songwriter, or should I say one profound lyricist named Lionel Richie. Do you know that guy? He once said, "It's easy. It's easy like Sunday morning." Some of you may say, well, when I was growing up, Sunday morning was not easy. It was like a hectic mess because everybody was fighting and trying to get ready and everything else all to get in the church. And so you might say, every time I listen to that song, it made absolutely no sense to me. Well, I think it's because he never went to church. That's why Sunday morning was easy for him. Pastor, if you knew everything that I went through this morning, you wouldn't even be excited about Sunday morning. But we have a reason to be excited. In fact, above all people and all creation, right? We have a reason to be excited. Because on this day, every Sunday, not just on Easter, we celebrate the one who conquered the grave. The one who gives us victory in all things. So today, if you're here in spirit, but not here in presence, if you're here in presence and you're not here in spirit, either way. If you're watching at home in your pajamas from home, I want to thank you for joining us. But I also want to remind you just how sacred this day actually is. See, there's something that happens when we gather together as a community of believers. When we set aside just for a moment all the other distractions of our lives and when we come together in praise and worship and we lift up His holy name, when we begin to magnify Him, the one and only one who is worthy of all of our praise, when we let the Word speak into our lives and change our hearts and renew our minds, we can leave different than what we came, right? We don't have to leave the same old people. We can leave and be radically different people. And I think that's when we experience what is truly the unexplainable joy of Sunday morning. What Sunday is really all about. It's not about the building. It's not about the music. Thank goodness it's not about the preacher. I know I can get some amens on that. But it's all about Him. It's all about the glory of our great God who loved us. I know we hear this all the time, but think about it. The one who loved us on our worst day. The one who chose to go to the cross to redeem us in spite of everything that we've done against Him. And the one who rose again on that third day, on that first Sunday morning, that first resurrection Sunday morning to give us victory in everything that we face in life. And that's why we're here today. That's what makes Sunday so great. All right, is He ever going to quit talking about Sundays? That's the end of it. In fact, that's the end of the message. This is the world's shortest message. I wanted to give you something that you could all get behind. Some of you would say, well, if that was the end, this Sunday really would be a great Sunday because that would be the best message I ever heard in 2 minutes. But, like I said earlier, the reason we can't do that, we got to be concerned as Christians about other people. I'm sorry I'm beginning with so much sarcasm this morning. That's just how it ended up. But we have to be concerned with other people, and those people have to get in their good 20 minutes. So that's why I preach 20 minutes every week. But I have wondered what happened if we all planned. You know, there's the certain people that I won't point out that have a tendency to doze off. If we all just quietly snuck out of the building. We laid our jackets on the pews, you know. And they woke up and suddenly everybody was gone and there was just random jackets everywhere. Then they would say, man, maybe I shouldn't have been sleeping during the preacher's sermon after all, you know. But on to the story today. Enough about that. In John 6, beginning in verse 16, where we pick up our journey through the Gospel of John. And I hope it's a story that you've been enjoying. And it's here that we encounter what is one of, if the most, if not the most iconic miracles, iconic scenes in the life of Christ, as Jesus quite miraculously and really beyond all human comprehension or explanation walks on the water to his disciples. A lot of people to this day wonder how Jesus did it. In fact, if you open up commentaries, it's kind of funny, I think, that throughout history, there's been all kinds of theories and explanations about how Jesus walked on water. And I'm just thinking, maybe you missed the purpose here. You know, maybe you missed the point. The fact that he did it was a miracle. But people have tried historically to explain this miracle away, just like every other miracle that Christ ever did. Some have suggested that Jesus really wasn't walking on water. He was actually just standing in water that was pretty shallow. Yeah, that's a good explanation, right? I think that's probably the best one in my opinion. Because the disciples who had spent their whole lives, right, fishing on these waters, they would have, not known that the water was only waist deep and Jesus wasn't really walking on water. But the text actually tells us here that they were 3 to 4 miles from shore in a lake that was over 150 feet deep. But not only that, the disciples, when they saw this, they believed it was an absolute, unbelievable and unexplainable miracle. They knew that every nook and cranny of this lake, and they knew that what Jesus was doing defied all explanation. So it really shows you some of the things that people would like to believe rather than actually believing the truth about Christ. I've been hanging out with my ancestors my family from Texas too long. So I'm getting a little bit of the Texas accent back. But it kind of reminds you of some of the claims that people make about the Gospels. And I think this is important to note before we move directly into the passage today. When people read the different accounts of the Gospels, they like to say that there's contradictions because the stories, they tell the story of Christ from a different perspective. But what they don't realize is that when we look at textual criticism, we know that all of the authors, when they wrote the Gospels, they actually knew what the other authors had written. There's evidence within the text that they knew what the other authors had written. But it goes to show you that since the beginning of time, people have been trying to distort the truth of Christianity. They've been trying to explain it all away, but there's no explaining away Jesus Christ. There's a reason why all these men were willing to give their lives for the sake of this man. And it was because they saw him do the impossible. And to a large degree, that's what we've been looking at all the way through the Gospel of John, and especially in the story that we look at today. All these miracles that prove who Jesus was because he did what only God could do. But if that is the case, if Jesus did what only God could do, what makes this miracle so special? I mean, he did the impossible, right? He fed the 5,000 in the scene that we looked at last week. Before that, he healed a man who had been lame for 38 years. Before that, he healed someone from a distance. Before that, he turned the water into wine. What sets this miracle apart? Have you ever asked yourself that? About Jesus walking on water. What makes this one of those unusual scenes that sticks within people's minds? You know, if you were to ask somebody really that knows absolutely nothing about Christianity, who do people say walked on water? I'm pretty sure whether someone had ever been in church or not, they would say Jesus, right? That's pretty evident. In fact, when I was researching this, I wanted to show you a clip of Bruce Almighty. This story where he actually gives given the powers of God and he realizes that he doesn't have it all figured out, even though, you know, people think that they're God and they think they could do a lot better job. But he learns that in a pretty profound way in this movie that is generally a secular movie. But one of the first things that he does is walks on water. It just shows you how iconic this scene actually is. But the real question, I think, as we take a closer look at this story is, why is this miracle in particular so important? And why does this scene and this miracle of all the miracles that Jesus performed so well known in our minds? You could go out in the street and ask people, who is the man who walked on water? And if they tell you Jesus, here's a good follow-up question you could ask them. Why do we say that about Jesus? Why do we consider that to be important? Why did John and Mark, who wrote this in keeping with what Peter had experienced on that day, think that this was so important? And that's the question that I actually want to answer today as we take a closer look at this passage. What does this mean? Why is it important for us to believe something like this? Here we read in verse 16, if you want to go ahead and turn there, when evening came. There's so much meaning and purpose within only those first three words. Because eventually, at some point in our lives, this symbolic scene is going to happen to each and every one of us. When evening came. You could easily look at the world today and say, I think that's where we are. Evening seems to be coming. We seem to be drawing ever closer to the end. And here we'll find that pretty soon this evening that was coming very quickly becomes complete darkness and chaos and a storm as they go out on the water. But here we read when evening came, and just as a side note, in the miracle we looked at last night when we were, a week ago when we slept one time and then we woke up today. But the miracle we looked at last week when Jesus fed the 5,000, that's actually the same day that this happened. So when the evening of that day had finally come to an end, we read in verse 16, the second half of the verse, that his disciples went down to the sea and they got in a boat and they started across the sea to Capernaum. For some reason, which we're not really told here, all the disciples, they decided they were going to leave. They're going to get out of Dodge. A lot of people don't know this, but Dodge is actually a coastal city of the Sea of Galilee. That's where that phrase actually comes from. It doesn't come from the Wild West. I got to stop with this. We got to focus on the actual text this morning. But they all left and they headed towards the city called Capernaum, which was kind of their base of operations. But I think the most important piece of this entire story, other than the fact that evening was coming and darkness was coming, was the fact that for some reason that we're not told here, they leave without Christ. These men who had been following Christ left on this night without Christ, and that's when they find themselves in the midst of the situation. And if we go back only a couple of verses to verses 14 and 15, we find the reason why. When all the people saw this great sign that Jesus had fed the 5,000 and all this food was left over, when they only had two fish and five loaves to begin with, Jesus perceived in his mind, because he knew the mind of men, that they were about to raise him up and make him king by force. So he withdrew, the text tells us, to a mountain, the sacred symbol that we talked about last week. That's why this message is in the shadow of the mountain. It's kind of a play of ideas, because they're in the shadow of this mountain, but they're also about to go through a shadow, kind of like the valley of the shadow of death. Something that's going to test their faith. Something that's going to test what they truly believe in. So he withdrew from this mountain that we talked about last week, and he went to have a little bit of me time, because even Jesus needs some me time, right? What's so interesting, if you think about it, is that Jesus was there in the scene that we looked at last week to meet the needs of the people, just like he had come to this world in the first place to meet the needs of creation. He was there among them doing the impossible to show that he was God. But when these people seek to raise Jesus up and make him king, he leaves. Why? Isn't that what he wanted? Didn't he want to be king? Didn't he want to be raised up? But the problem was, they wanted to raise him up for their own purpose. Here we find a scene that's very similar to the Tower of Babel, symbolically. They wanted to build a tower up to God, but it wasn't because they had respect for God. It's because they wanted to make themselves like God. Here they wanted to raise Jesus up so he could conquer all of Israel's enemies and they could rule the world, but that's not the reason Jesus came. He came to bring them freedom. He came to be the King of Kings, but it wasn't in a way that anybody expected. So he left that day. He who fed the people and came to minister to the people left the people because they wanted to make it about their own agenda rather than Christ's agenda. That's why he says, I didn't come to do the will of man, but the will of the Father. I didn't even come to do my own will. I came to do the will of God. It's the same thing we saw in the miracle when Jesus turned the water into wine. Jesus said, woman, what does this have to do with me? I came to do the will of the Father, right? I didn't come to do party tricks. But think about this for a moment. Here, even though Jesus came to prove himself to be God, when they made it about their own agenda, that's when he left the people. And I say, I can say the same thing for the church. When we make it about our own agenda rather than about Christ, when we make it all about God conforming to our standard of morality rather than us conforming to his standard of morality, he leaves us as well. And then things start to go downhill, and then we say, God, don't you care? Don't you care about your church? Look at what's happening to the church. And he says, well, guess what? The church wasn't what I wanted it to be in the first place. That's why I left, so you would realize it. And so Jesus leaves for some alone time in the shadow of this mountain. And even though we're not told exactly how the conversation went among the disciples, once they realized that Jesus was gone and he wasn't coming back, they left. I don't know why, but maybe they had no concern for Jesus. I guess he was just going to swim across the lake. You know, we're not told why they leave him. But they realize he's gone. He's not coming back. They get out of there. Those 5,000 people, they're going to get hungry again. How are we going to feed them? They each had their basket. Maybe they want to give it up. I have no idea. But it's not really important to the story. So they set out towards Capernaum, went along the way. In the second half of verse 17, we're told two very important details. What was evening had now become dark. Darkness had enveloped them. And it's really a picture of what was happening in the entire world at this time. It's a picture of the world today. What is evening is going to become night, right? When you see these signs happening, you know that the end is drawing near. That's our signs. It always happens like that. There's no exceptions to that. And secondly, John tells us this second ever so critical detail. Jesus had not yet come. It's two relatively minor details that really don't seem that important in the moment. Or they wouldn't have gotten the boat in the first place. But when we consider what happened next, and when we consider what Jesus came to do, everything that Jesus was, and everything that Jesus came to do, it's really profound truths. The fact that Jesus was, in John's own word, the light that was sent into darkness. This light that shows us a better way. This light that shows us the perfect way to God. John tells us that he was the light that shone in darkness, that darkness was unable to comprehend. He was the true light that was rejected by men. Why? Because we love darkness rather than light. Because our deeds were evil. But Jesus came to speak into the darkness of this world. Jesus came, in essence, to carry us safely to the shore. And in a way, what happened on that night is a picture of the history of the world itself. Think about this. In the beginning, the scripture tells us that God created us in his image and his likeness. That he prepared a garden for us that met our every need. That he fed us just like he fed the 5,000 in the scene just before this. Yet because of our sin and our rebellion, we broke ourselves away from him. We set out in the boat alone. We sought our own will and our own way rather than him. And just like the people had done on that day, we sought even God for our own agenda. And because of that, we were separated from God's presence. He removed himself from us, and we became a people that really he could no longer have his will among. He even gave us his image, and we scorned his image. We distorted his image, and we sought our own image. We sought the image of creation, the created things, rather than the image of the one true God. So he could no longer have this unique relationship that he had with us in the garden. He left us. and went away to the mountain. And eventually we became just like the disciples on that night. On this perilous journey in the darkness. And they don't even know why they're leaving, right? Why are they even leaving? Sometimes I feel like that's our lives and that's our world today. We're in the middle of the sea, and not only are we overwhelmed by all the circumstances of our lives, we really don't even know why we left in the first place, right? Have you ever been there? I don't even know why we left without Jesus. Why didn't we just wait around? Do you think they had that conversation along the way? We're not told it. I told you we should wait for Jesus. Maybe John said that and he just didn't include it because he didn't want to say, I told you so. But think about this. They're on this perilous journey in the darkness, in the midst of the raging sea, and they're desperately rowing against the wind and the sea and the waves. And no matter what they do, they can't get any closer to the shore. No matter how hard they struggle, they're still about 3 to 4 miles out. They can't get any closer to their destination, and they have no idea what their destination is anyways. That's what this world was, and that's what our lives are before Christ came. It was before Jesus came to them. Christ had not come to them yet. You know, that kind of infers that Christ is going to show up. And we know the story, so we know that he's going to show up. But guess what? There's people's lives, and there's people even here today, there's people that may be listening to this, that's the state of their lives for the rest of their lives. And how tragic is that? Christ had not shown up yet. See, when we look at the world, we can so easily judge the world because they don't have our same morality and ethics. But they're still in that desperate situation. There's still the people struggling against the wind and the sea and the waves, and Christ isn't in with them. So us who have Christ in the boat have to be the ones that reach out to them and say, hey, look at what happened to me. Now he's in the boat and everything's okay, right? Maybe that makes absolutely no sense. I don't know. I got some pretty strange looks on that one. But that's what many of our lives still are to this day. That's what a life without him will always be. A life without Christ in the boat will always be a life of darkness and despair, a life without peace, a future that's uncertain, a life of striving and struggling against the wind and the seas and complete futility. That's all life is without Jesus. Because without him, there's no hope of ever making it to shore. That's all life will ever be without him, as Solomon said, with all of his wealth and all of his wisdom. All life will be is a struggling after the wind without Jesus. And as I think about what it must have been like on that night, as I was reading through this passage this week, I was like, man, that's our world today. If ever there was a picture of our world today, I think it has to be the picture of the disciples on this night. So we see people living in fear and dread because of this virus. So we see people rioting, striving after the wind, fighting, and they don't even know what they're fighting for. I see these 12 disciples desperately rowing, trying to get to shore. Maybe as you hear this story today, you realize that's you. I'm in that boat. Jesus isn't with me. Maybe you realize that somewhere along the way, you set out on this journey and you set out on it without Jesus and you don't even know why. Or maybe your life seems like that all you're ever doing is just constantly rowing and never really getting anywhere. If that is you today, I want you to know, Christ hasn't abandoned you. Sometimes we're all alone in the boat. We think it's because Jesus left us, when the truth is, we left him. This isn't the end of your story. For even though, as the text tells us here, that Christ had not yet come, within the words themselves, we already know that he's about to show up. Before the disciples had ever even left, even before the world was ever created, we read this, and I think this is so important. One of the first things, interestingly enough, that we're told in Genesis 1 and 2, when God created the heavens and the earth, this water that is such this powerful symbol in this scene, that the Spirit of God hovered over the waters of the deep. Within the ancient mind, water represented chaos and destruction. And so when they read those words, what they were reading is that God is greater than the chaos and the destruction of this world. The Spirit of God hovered over the waters of the deep. In other words, God has control over all things. And to me, that's a little sign that long before they ever set out on this journey, before he ever called the disciples in the first place, before there was even a man on this world, God was already calming the seas. He wasn't going to let his disciples die. He wasn't going to give up on them, and he's not going to give up on us. He's always with us. He has a plan for our life that's so much greater than you can ever possibly imagine. But before their story ever began, Jesus knew how this story was going to end. He never had a single intention of losing a single one of his disciples. In fact, he actually goes on to say that later in John chapter 6. I've kept all those that he has given me in his hands. But sometimes I think in life it takes going out in the boat to realize that we need Jesus in the boat. And I think that's exactly what happens on this night. We read in verse 19, when they had rowed out about 3 to 4 miles, that's when they saw Jesus walking on the sea. And what a sight it must have been. Think about this. In a world of chaos and struggle, you not know where you're going. You're not getting any closer to shore. And then you see Jesus. That's what we all need to experience, right? That glimpse of Jesus that shows us he's in control. Not only that he's in control, he's God. They saw Jesus walking on the sea and coming near to the boat, and they were frightened. When Christ suddenly appeared and they saw him walking on the sea, they didn't even know how to begin to process that. It went against everything that they ever knew or thought about the world. For even though they knew that Christ could do the impossible, that's what he's been doing throughout the whole Gospel of John, this went against everything that they even conceived was possible. And that's the entire point. But look at what happens here. It says that they were afraid. They were terrified. The word that's used here is actually phobia, where we get our word phobia. And it means to be shaken to our core. It's an irrational fear. And that's actually what it was on this night. Because we have no reason to be afraid of Christ, and yet they were afraid of Christ. But why were they afraid of Christ? Because they realized, as scary as the storm was, they had just met someone that was more powerful than the storm. That's a scary thing. But sometimes I don't think we think about God like that. We don't have that awe, reverent fear of who he is, the mighty maker of heavens and the maker of earth, right? This past week, about 2 days ago, the sirens blew. And two of my sisters were in the car with me, and they said, "Do you think that we should seek shelter?" There's something about a storm that reminds us there's a world so much bigger than us, right? But to think that there's a God that's so much bigger than the storm is something even more profound and more amazing. And it can fill you with fear. There was someone in their presence that was more powerful than anything else in this world, and his name was Jesus. And think about this, even though they had met him quite a long time before this, maybe 1 year, maybe 2 years, maybe it's even getting closer to 3 years. They had met this man long before this night, and they had chosen to follow him. They had followed him in faith, and they had seen him do the impossible. In that moment, I think they might have realized for the very first time that they weren't just meeting another man. They were actually meeting God in the flesh. How many of you have met him and realized who he actually is? On that moment, they were meeting someone whose power and glory they could not even begin to fathom. For not only was he unaffected by the wind and the waves, but the very water that was threatening to take their lives only moments before was holding him up.
because of the power and the authority of who He is. See, here Jesus shows them that there is a power and the authority far beyond everything in this world. There is a name above all names. There's a power above all powers. There's a strength that's above all strengths. And His name is Jesus. There's a reality that's beyond this physical reality. There's a world beyond what we can see and we can understand with our senses. There's an unseen spiritual reality that supersedes and it displaces all the powers of this world. And that's the reality that Jesus came to reveal. And I think that's what makes this scene so important. How did Jesus walk on water? I know why. I know how, I should say. That's why He fasted for 40 days and 40 nights. So He was skinny enough to walk on water. That's how He did it. I spent a lot of time studying Him. That's the conclusion I came to. Or maybe like I was talking about in the beginning, the water just wasn't that deep. Maybe that's how Jesus was able to walk on water. No, I think that misses the point entirely. The reason that Jesus was able to walk on water is because all the things that rule our world don't rule Him. All the laws of physics that govern our lives, they don't govern Him. And so the water that threatened death actually submitted itself to Jesus Christ, just like death itself submitted itself to Jesus. And that's why He gives life to us. For the Scripture says, if the same Spirit that raised Christ from the dead dwells in us, if the same Spirit that hovered over the waters of the deep in Genesis 1 and 2 dwells in us, it will also quicken our mortal bodies, and this corruptible will put on incorruption. It doesn't have a physical explanation, because it's God. And that's a glimpse of what they saw on that night. They saw a glimpse of God who is so far beyond what we could ever possibly understand. And they saw Him face to face. And they were scared. And I think rightly so. To me, it's a terrifying thing if you think about the power and the majesty of God. There's a reason why Isaiah, who was a righteous man, when he saw God high and lifted up, said, "Woe is me, I'm undone." Because they realized His glory. There's a reason why Moses was afraid. There's a reason why Abraham was afraid. There's a reason why every person who faces God face to face is afraid, because He's a terrifying person, right? But it's not because we should fear Him. It's because He's so far beyond what we can possibly fathom. And I think that's what makes this such a powerful scene. Because as they stand there being terrified, Jesus says what I believe are some of the most profound words in all of Scripture. He says, "It is I, fear not." Did they know who Jesus was before that day? Yeah, they knew who He was. But they're seeing Him in a new way that terrified them, right? Here they're seeing that this man they were following was so much more than a man. And Jesus says, "I'm still the same person that I've always been. It is I. Fear not." And that's exactly what we need in our lives today. Jesus to reveal Himself and show that He's greater than the storm. He's greater than the wind. He's greater than the waves. He's greater than everything that we would face in this life. He is greater than it all, but He's also a friend that sticks closer than a brother. He's also this God that we've been following our whole lives. He's also the God that loved us enough to die for us on a cross. It's I, fear not. And we can so easily forget about that when we face the storms of this life. Who Jesus is and who Jesus will always be. But when Jesus reveals Himself, and this is the closing today, the disciples have a choice. They that left the shore without Jesus are never going to get to the shore without Jesus unless they let Jesus in the boat. It's something that doesn't seem that complicated, right? Jesus is in the boat. They make it safely to shore. End of story. It's all a bed of roses. It's an amazing story. The only problem is, and the tragic part of this whole story, is there's people that will spend the rest of their lives struggling against the wind and the seas, even though Jesus reveals himself to them, and even though he says, "It's I, fear not," because they're never going to let Jesus in the boat. And maybe that's you today. Maybe you've been living your life without Jesus in the boat. The world is filled with things that try to keep us from letting him in the boat. Distractions, fear, anxiety, things that distract us from who he is. But look at how this scene ends in verse 20. We read, "But he said to them, 'It is I, do not be afraid.' Then they were glad to take him in the boat." They received Jesus with joy because they realized who Jesus was. And eventually, they made it to shore. Immediately, they made it to shore. As soon as Jesus was in the boat, this boat find its way throughout the whole night to the shore, was immediately at the shore. In other words, Jesus did in an instant what these fishermen couldn't do in an entire night. And I think the implications of this story are pretty clear. We need Jesus in the boat. We need Jesus in our lives. We need Jesus in this church. We need Jesus in this nation. But we can go the rest of our lives and never make him a priority, never make him Lord, continue to go out on the water without him for whatever reason, but for whatever reason that is today, set it aside, let him in the boat, and find yourself at the shore. He's the one who can still the waters. He's the one who can do the impossible. He's the one who is truly God. He's the one who redeems. But we have a choice to make. What choice are you going to make today? You going to continue to go through life without him, or are you going to let him in the boat, let him take over your lives and carry you safely to shore? If you would, please stand and let's go, Lord, in prayer.